when a man, going, summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. The one who had received the 5 talents went off at once and traded them and made 5 more talents. In the same way, the one who had the 2 talents made 2 more talents. But the one who had received the 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. Then the one who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 more talents, saying, "Master, you handed over to me 5 talents. See, I have made 5 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enjoy the joy of your master." And the one with the 2 talents came forward, saying, "Master, you handed over to me 2 talents. See, I have made 2 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master." Then the one who had received the one talent came forward, saying, "Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not scatter seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours." But his master replied, "You wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one with 10 talents. For to all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for this worthless slave, throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." The gospel of our Lord.
Thanks to you, Lord Christ. Woohoo! Yeah! Please be seated. I'm glad you picked up on that last line there. What a great way to, what a great place to land, right? For the gospel tradition, this weeping and gnashing of teeth. And of course, a lot of us got stuck on that line, "You wicked and worthless slave," you know, wicked and lazy. It's like, oh boy. So we're gonna do some context on that because we're wrapping up our ongoing relationship with the gospel according to Matthew. Next Sunday is the last Sunday of the church's year. It's known as the Feast of Christ the King. And then we're going to get comfortable and cozy with another of the gospel traditions. This is year A, Matthew. Next year, starting the beginning of Advent, is year B. That would be the gospel according to Mark. Very good. And then after that, in a year, year C, the gospel according to Luke. So we're going to say bye-bye to the gospel according to Matthew on such a lovely and upbeat note. A little bit of background about these lessons. First, the test that Karen passed with flying colors in the book of Judges. I mean, there are more place names, difficult and impossible to pronounce place names, in that one little section of Judges than perhaps in all of the rest of the lessons that we've come across so far this year. And as we've noticed in the lectionary, this follows on a serial reading from the first five books of the Hebrew Scriptures, known as the Pentateuch, ending with the story of Moses at the end of Deuteronomy. And now they are in the Promised Land, and it's on. There's all kinds of issues coming up. I mean, and when people say, oh, poor Moses, boy, he must have really screwed up because he died before he got to the Promised Land, that is not the case at all. Trust me. I mean, if you begin to read the stories in the books of Joshua and Judges, as soon as they enter the Promised Land, it is just a hot mess. And this is a part of that story with what are called the judges. And what's interesting in the books of Joshua and Judges, as the history, as time goes on in the Promised Land, is that at the beginning, the status of women, which is reflected in this particular passage, is pretty high. I mean, Deborah is acknowledged as a judge. There are a couple of other women early on who are acknowledged as judges. In other words, not sort of as legal judges, but also what you might think of as spiritual directors, kind of a combo court judge and spiritual director, if you can imagine that combination. But as the book of Judges unfolds, the status of women begins to drop to the point where they end up back worse than what they started. And by the end of the book of Judges, women are considered nothing more than chattel, property, objects to be used and tossed as the community would see fit. And I bring this up because according to the books of Joshua and Judges, the spiritual health and well-being of a community can be gauged by the status of the women in the community. I mean, and if you don't take my, read them and see what's going on. As the status of women drops, the disconnect with God increases. And they go, those two things in the Hebrew Scriptures go hand in hand. And what that means is that to this day, you and I can gauge our own spiritual health and well-being by the manner in which we treat our women. And that's a powerful gauge, and I wanted to, you know, put that out in the light, because we don't always want to see that. Right? But please just file that by title. And also in the ancient tradition, the manner in which women are treated, revered, respected, goes also hand in hand with the way strangers, children, those who are at the margins of society are treated as well. And there's a huge tradition in the Hebrew Scriptures and in the Jewish faith communities that you can also gauge the spiritual health and well-being of a faith community by the way it treats the stranger and the other. So, file that by title. And then we get to this fabulous story in the Gospel according to Matthew, with weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth, and you wicked and lazy slave, which you already knew. I mean, you knew that about yourself. before Betty even introduced the reading. And I want to take you, again, when it comes to the gospel tradition and the scriptures, context is everything. So, you may have noticed, some of you that were paying attention, that when you looked at the pew rack in front of you, that there's one less book and one more book. And what we did is we removed a hymnal from your pew rack and put in either a large print prayer book. Not all the pews have a large print book because some of you are holding out on that need, but it'll catch up with you. And we also put a Bible in the pew rack along with another prayer book. And so, yeah. And again, the whole point was to kind of declutter the pews, because I noticed over the last couple of weeks, we've got all kinds of books sort of scattered all over the, sitting on the pew cushions, and so thought, let's clean this up a little bit. So, what I want to do is have you bust out the Bible that's in front of you. I know, this is pushing the river. Yeah, the Episcopal police are at the front door. They are ready to bust us if we get out of line. And I want you to find the 21st chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew. What I'd like to do is take you through a quick blast of this section of Matthew in order to understand what we're dealing with in the Gospel reading today. So, it's the 21st chapter of the Gospel according to Matthew. I could tell you that in the little blue Bible it's on page 17, but that's not going to help you at all, because each section is renumbered in this Bible as you go. Everybody got Matthew? Chapter 21, just the whole thing. We're actually not going to go verse by verse today, Susan. I know she likes to do that a lot. So we're just going to go by section. So you'll see, again, the context is that Jesus has now entered Jerusalem in chapter 21, and then flip the page. He cleanses the temple. Again, this is a symbolic act. He doesn't actually alter the entire economy of the city of Jerusalem. That never happens. And then one of my fun sections, he curses the fig tree. That's a whole sermon in and of itself. And then comes the question of authority. I mean, because he's teaching with authority. They are living in a war zone. Everybody is trying to figure out who is in charge here. And, of course, Imperial Rome is saying to the Jewish people of the Palestine, if you would just shut up for a minute, you would realize that we're in charge and you just got to do what we tell you to do. Well, it's already too late for that by the first century of the Common Era. So the war is on. And so you'll see all kinds of parables. The two sons, the wicked tenants, we've read some of these already, the wedding banquets, questions about paying taxes, we went over that, question about the resurrection, the great commandment, Jesus is having conversation with his buddies, the Pharisees, the Sadducees are throwing in, some other, the scribes, all kinds of folks are coming and going here in the city of Jerusalem in this whole scene. And then again, you'll see a question about David's son. Again, that's a question of authority. Who does this guy think he is? And then in chapter 23, you'll see it says Jesus denounces the scribes and Pharisees. consistently throughout all four of the Gospels, and actually five if you include the Gospel of Thomas, which may be one of the earliest sources for a lot of these stories. The only people that Jesus goes after are the religious leaders of his day. Those are the only people he goes after. And you got to ask yourself, if he were to show up today, who would he go after? Yeah.
You.
Yeah. And then you'll see in chapter 24, the destruction of the temple is foretold. I am here to tell you that the reason this section is in the gospel according to Matthew is because the temple has already been destroyed. There is no foretell here. It's already happened. This gospel was written long after the first destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. So again, Jesus doesn't have some kind of a crystal ball going on here. And then he's talking about the signs of the end of the age, and unlike, again, a lot of folks who will tell you that the end of the age is all about the end of the world, those are two very different things that move in very different directions. Jesus never talks about the end of the world. He talks about the transformation of all creation and the community of humanity is what that is all about. It's a whole different trajectory than, oh, the end of the world is coming. I mean, if you imagine that in light of the end of the age, that humanity would actually lay down all its weapons and begin to learn how to get along, if that is the end of the world for you, then so be it. But that's what Jesus is really talking about. And then stuff about the coming of the Son of Man you'll see in chapter 24. Are you guys with me so far here? Okay. And here's what's interesting about the gospel according to Matthew, and it kind of ties into our lesson today, and that is that in Matthew's gospel there are these references to a second coming, and it's not where the actual gospel ends. In the gospel according to Matthew, there is no second coming. But there are all these references to the possibility of a second coming. And the clue here is that these ancient authors, and this author in particular, who is more interested in what we would call scribal wisdom, which would be comprised of some really cool and extremely provocative stories like ours today, and could care less about the details. So these references to the possibility of a second coming set right next to the fact that in the gospel according to Matthew there is no second coming is not a problem at all for this author. Now, if you can wrap your brain around that, come see me. I'd love to hear it. Because they don't, you just can't hold them together. And the author of the gospel according to Matthew goes, whatever, you know. Take whatever you want, leave the rest. And then, finally, we are in chapter 25, parable of the 10 bridesmaids, which we heard last week, and now we're at what's called the parable of the talents. And all of this whole section of the gospel according to Matthew, which then leads into the scene of Jesus being arrested, being tried by Imperial Rome, and then crucified as a common criminal, all of this revolves around two basic issues for this author and this particular ancient community, and they are these. What does a faithful life look like? What does faithful discipleship comprise? That's one. And the other, again, because they're living in a war zone and people are being hunted, they are being persecuted, families are being destroyed, livelihoods are being crushed, cities are set to flame, on it goes. And, you know, with this kind of pressure coming from Imperial Rome, they need to know who's in and who's out. And who might be showing up as a spy who's going to rat us out to Imperial Rome, which means we're going to be arrested, we're going to be tortured, we're going to be literally thrown to the lions. I mean, these ancient faithful people became entertainment for Imperial Rome, all around Imperial Rome with the Colosseums. and gladiators and, you know, lions and tigers and bears and ripping people to shreds. I mean, that was their fate. They need to know who's in, who is one of us. And so these questions keep arising. Now, you and I don't live with that kind of pressure. I mean, we are not spending our days protecting ourselves and our loved ones against some force from the outside that is hunting us down in order to persecute us for what we say we believe. That's not happening. And so the question of who's in and who's out is not our primary concern. Right? Right? Thank you. And again, so much of what I refer to as popular Christianity seems to hunker down around that one issue. Who's in, who's out, who's going to heaven, who's going to hell, on and on it goes, and it's just not helpful stuff at all. So the operative question for us is, what does a faithful life look like? What does faithful discipleship look like? How does it act? How does it think? How does it process the world? On and on it goes. And again, in the context of Matthew's agenda and the agenda of this ancient community, they would have heard this story of these various slaves who are given huge amounts of money. A talent would be the equivalent of 15 to 20 years average wage. So, you know, if you do, math is not my skill, which is why we have such a fabulous finance committee that keeps me at arm's length, thankfully, and doesn't ask me questions about how we should handle our finances. Thank God for the finance committee. That would be the equivalent of somewhere between maybe $300,000 and $500,000 that this master hands the first slave, and then say $250,000 to $400,000 to the second slave, and then, I don't know, about $150,000 to $200,000 to the third slave. It's a lot of money, right? And what we miss, and what is implied in this story, is that once the master gives them this money, they are no longer slaves. They are free, which in terms of their status in the world is an enormous transition and transformation for them. Two of them figure it out. And the third one hasn't quite fired on the fact that he's now free. And so he buries, you know, the money and then hands that same amount back to the master, which was never part of the deal to begin with. They were given these stashes of cash free and clear. And the original hearers among Jesus or among the members of Matthew's community would have, their minds would have been blowing for starters, but they would also have initially identified with the third guy who buries. And everyone in that ancient community would have said that was a really smart move, because in order to double or make money on what they've been given, they would have had to conspire with Imperial Rome. In other words, they would have had to do business with the enemy. And so when you begin to unpack this story from the vantage point of this ancient people in the first century, all of a sudden you begin to get the impression that Jesus is just twisting people's heads off in all kinds of ways. Oh my God, what do you mean? They go and make money and they're conspiring with Imperial Rome and they're the enemy and blah, blah, blah. And there's no commentary, there's no judgment, there's no nothing in the story in that regard, other than this master says, go get them. I want to suggest that takes us way beyond any concern that you and I might have regarding being wicked and lazy slaves. And again, it takes us into that place where we get to ask the question, what does a faithful life look like today? And today, I want to suggest that a faithful life looks like this. Look around. A faithful life looks like this, folks. 8 o'clockers and 10 o'clockers trying to figure out who's sitting in your pew and who are these people and what do they want with us and what's going to happen at the annual meeting and, you know, what about our future and yada, yada. And here we are. Now, there's a prayer that we use. Brian's got it on the screen that I wanted to show you real quick. And it's an adaptation of what is known in recovery communities as the third step prayer. And during the 10 o'clock service, we use it every Sunday during the regular year. We'll, you know, come the season of whatever, Lent or something, we'll swap it out for some other prayers. But in the meantime, this is kind of our go-to when we are wrapping up the prayers that we've offered to God on behalf of ourselves and the wider community, and ultimately the world. And it's in there. I just know it is. Here it is. Some of you are going to recognize this. It goes like this. God, we offer ourselves to you. This is where faithful living begins. Here I am, good and bad, warts and all. You know, we're yours. Keep going, Brian. To build and do with us as you will. One of my daily challenges is coming up with all kinds of brilliant ideas based on my hard-won worldly wisdom, which I will then inflict on everyone I can get my hands on, and I confuse those brilliant ideas with the will of God. And so, again, rather than give ourselves a hard time about that, or, oh, you wicked and lazy slave, is to say, okay, we're going back to square one. We will do what we can to discern the will of God. Keep going, Brian. Relieve us of the bondage of self. I think I just described some of that. The bondage of self can take on all kinds of aspects in our lives. Again, it takes some doing on occasion to figure out the difference between all the ways that we serve ourselves and the ways that can be transformed into what I like to think of as enlightened self-interest on behalf of the rest of the community. And so we ask God to relieve us of the bondage of self, so that we may better do God's will, which we had just mentioned prior. See, and this is the part, this is a little rewrite of the third step prayer, and I really like this. Brian and Hallie were the ones that came up with this. See us through our difficulties, including the grinding in the head. I mean, where most of our difficulties start and end is the grind, right? See us through our difficulties as our lives are witness. We claim our place in the communion of the saints, which we talked about on All Saints Day, witness to your power, your love, your way of life. May we do your will always. Good answer. This is what a faithful life looks like. This is what it sounds like. I mean, it sounds like us. And it sounds like any number of other billions of people that occupy this planet who are, you know, attempting in good faith to do the same thing. This is what faithful discipleship looks like. It's where it begins, and in one sense, it's also where it ends, with all kinds of messes and questions and screw-ups and mistakes. I mean, one of the things I ran across in my morning reflection, a reflection from a Roman Catholic monk who described his upbringing as a place where you had to get it right the first time, and that you couldn't make mistakes. You know, the whole thing about venial sins and mortal sins, and, you know, there's a whole stepladder of sins, and every time you turn around, the church is going to identify yet another sin, you know, that you have committed. On and on it goes. And there's no elbow room in a system like that whatsoever, until you get to the point where I did as a youngster and went, you know what, forget, let's just sin. Let's just go for it, right? I mean, if we're going to be sinners, then let's really give it the old heave-ho, which is not a helpful approach. I would not recommend this to the kids, AJ. Keep with the robotics, right? Go for the robotics. In our tradition, and in the ancient faith tradition, there's all kinds of elbow room to mess up, because it's how we learn. It's how we begin to discern what God would have of us. We get to screw up. And so when we get to that point, after our prayers, and we recite this prayer together, just, you know, give yourself a moment to be mindful of what it is that we're doing, what it is that we're saying, and that this is the faithful life. This is faithful discipleship at its very best. So, take a moment. Take a nice deep breath. Take a couple of deep breaths.